Chapter 3. Do not be anxious. Do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor about your body, what you shall put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Which of you, by being anxious, can add one cubit to his stature? Therefore, do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek all these things. Your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be yours as well. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Let the day's trouble be sufficient for the day. Matthew 6:25, 27, 31-33.
When you read these words from the Sermon on the Mount, it will be clear that they are not designed for everyone, but for a group set apart, a group of pupils of a Christian mystery school. Man of this nature, man as a herd animal, born and bred on this hard clod of earth, knows the struggle for life. He knows what it means to eat his bread in the sweat of his brow. Since this judgment is sealed in his blood as an hereditary fear, he seeks possession of as much bread as possible at the cost of as little sweat as possible. This is the cause of social strife, war, economic anarchy, terror, and the dullness of the masses. This innate fear underlies education and dialectical science. Everything revolves around life, food, and clothing. This is the triangle of our existence, and who would think of denying it? Man is like an animal, snatching food from his own kind out of the urge of self-preservation. It is a natural instinct from the remote past. We are, ladies and gentlemen, as long as this natural instinct is not interfered with, and we are religious, humanistic, and highly civilized, as long as our lives, food, and clothing are not endangered. Do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat, or what you shall drink, nor about your body, what you shall put on. This was certainly not said to the man living in the tensions and disturbances of this age. Doesn't it mock our reality? Perhaps we remember the years of starvation during the Second World War, when distress existed on several levels. Wasn't it our duty then to protect our children and hunt for the necessities of life? In the sweat of our brow, we could not even eat bread. It was not available. We could only, to a certain extent, agree with, "Do not be anxious about tomorrow." Indeed, the terrible sorrow of everyday life, the tensions that demanded our attention, did not give us time to reflect on tomorrow. No wonder that many understood the Sermon on the Mount as cheap, religious optimism suited for the smooth days of peace and prosperity, suited for use by the theologian trying to pacify a member of the church who was indignant about exploitation by his employer. If we recognize another meaning in the Sermon on the Mount, we will know that it applies to a particular group of pupils and is not meant for everyone. We cannot judge whether the Sermon on the Mount is directed to you personally or whether it is right for you to reflect on it. It is possible that if you trust in it, you will be disappointed. Many of those who did soon switched over to the struggle for life, and we must say these level-headed people were sometimes quite right. This part of the Sermon on the Mount does not lend itself to experimentation. Therefore, do not let yourself go in a humiliating exaltation because it concerns great and sacred things. Superficial Christianity of this era has already dealt the Christ so many blows in the sacred face that we should not make it worse than it already is. You are not allowed to trust these words from the Sermon on the Mount. You must not believe in them. You cannot experiment with them. You can only grow towards them. Therefore, our discussion of this subject has meaning only for those who are in this process of growth and are in need of orientation. seek first the kingdom. Few of us will not have had some strange experience in life. In particular, we refer to the experience that when the need is urgent, help is at hand. It will have happened that you were in need of something, and it came. Some will have attributed this to an answer to their prayers. Others will have accepted it as a mere lucky break, but anyhow it came. This experience is so age-old that it gave rise to one of those true philosophical proverbs, one of those maxims that preserve primitive knowledge. The darkest hour is just before dawn. It is a divine law that prevails in the spheres of matter and spirit, a law so powerful, lofty, and dynamic that even in a world of atheism it will prove itself. This law teaches that for every entity in the universe who is differentiated from the divine being, there exists a complete possibility to live. As soon as an entity becomes conscious again in the cosmos, everything he may need for his sustenance or for his task of building is at hand. As soon as the central divine spark proves to be within him, he will maintain with his brothers and sisters the fire of God's plan of love and carry it along to the goal. Such persons are cared for, and everything they may need is available. No anarchy exists in God's plan. All is there for all. That is a law. If the pupil restores the oneness with this law, it will put him in possession of his inheritance, and he will be immensely rich. The Heavenly Father knows his needs, wherever he may be. This is not an edifying sermon, for your presence in the cosmos entails maintenance, so worrying is unintelligent. The fact that everything in nature is obliged to worry and be anxious will make the pupil realize that he is off course and should try to rediscover life in its relation to the original law. Therefore, one of the foremost necessities on the path is to find and answer the question, how shall I direct my spiritual effort? Must I break through matter to the true state, or must I learn to conquer matter through the spirit? How do I come into possession of my inheritance? To the Sermon on the Mount is very explicit on this point. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all other things shall be yours as well. Then all these other things will no longer constitute a problem. Towards all these things, necessary though they may be, leans the search of earthly-minded man. Should I deny my material interests then? Mustn't I educate my children so that they will be able to hold their own in society? Should I let things take their own course? If you bring up questions like this, it proves that you worry that the problem is still too much for you. For one who has experienced something of the true kingdom and its righteousness does not ask such questions any longer. The searching and striving of the earthly minded have lost their color for him. Ne concerned with the new life, and from that moment on, his inheritance is waiting for him. Is there is no question here of burning one's bridges and trusting all the rest to chance. There is no question here of being a parasite and taking advantage of the work, time, and money of others. Receiving and giving away. So then, is this how it is? If I adopt the true life, the kingdom, and his righteousness, will ordinary mortals supply my needs? Will those who have already safely provided for themselves with regard to material things pilot me nicely into the new realm? Material possessions can never help you to enter the new life. When you enter it, there are no people who are condemned or called to serve you. When any true spiritual work is accomplished for the benefit of those who cling to this nature, it can be started without a penny. It does not need to collect funds, yet it will not lack anything. What is needed will flow in from all sides, neither too much nor too little. This operation of the law comes about only when everything received is transmuted and given back for the benefit of all. However, the Sermon on the Mount does not refer to this. If you seek to understand, you will have to renounce matter and the connected brain convolutions. When Christ speaks the words we have quoted, he addresses the pupils who are on the mountain, the initiates. Such people are not worried about food and drink and clothing in the common, trivial sense. Pupils of the spiritual school who are laboriously ascending the path have a different longing. They long for the true life, for spiritual food and drink, and for being clothed with the heavenly body, as Paul expressed it. And this is their concern, their constant thought at a certain stage of their development. But this concern is wrong. It makes one ill. It is dialectical. No pupil on the path, by being concerned about his spiritual status, can add one cubit to his stature. As a pupil, you need to seek one thing only, the kingdom and his righteousness. This seeking is no new form of exploitation or of being exploited, but it means to establish, to lay the foundations, to build. Do the work. If you are a pupil, if you have been called as a pupil, then, according to your state of being, proceed to serve the true kingdom and his righteousness. Do this with your entire being. Do not think of your own spiritual development with all its needs. Don't these needs exist? Certainly, but do not think of them. Do not stop at them. Do the work, regardless of all the shortcomings you feel so strongly, with the stinging pain of imperfection, because you stand in the light of God on the mountain. Do the work. All the rest will come afterwards. It will be given to you. When? Where? How? That is of no importance. As a pupil of the spiritual school, you know the path of liberation, and this knowledge was not given to augment your unrest and your worry. You received it as a grace to enable you to recognize the Son of Man at his coming. Therefore, experience the words of Christ. My grace be sufficient for you. We stand in the present time with all its miseries, sorrows, and pitch-black darkness in the power of this grace. You have to do your work as a child of God in the present, and there are tensions that oppose you. Break these tensions by virtue of your calling and the grace bestowed on you. Do not talk and speculate about tomorrow. Place yourself before your task and act. This is the objectivity of the Sermon on the Mount, the effectiveness of Jesus Christ. There are many who cannot understand this, and although called to the mountain, they keep worrying about initiations and new spiritual food supposed to be necessary for their advancement. Throw your eye overboard. Do away with your self-maintenance. Sacrifice yourself on the altar of service, not tomorrow, but today.
To be able to do this, you need love for mankind and a heart ready to offer the sacrifice of the blood. The pupils on the mount who are being warned are sinners on a higher level.
There are those who fret about their lower life and those who fret about their higher life. Neither of the two is liberating. Only he who is prepared to lose his life for Jesus' sake will find it. Therefore, do understand the effectiveness of the Sermon on the Mount. Today, build with those who are your brothers and sisters the foundations of the kingdom and his righteousness. Be a Freemason. To all those who ascend the mountain of the Spirit, it is said, lose your self-will. Do not worry about the unfoldment of your life, the spiritual powers and values you might need on the path. Life itself is at stake, the life of renewal. Dismiss all higher self-seeking and anxiety about the self. Seek the kingdom and his righteousness. Fulfill the law of love after the example of Christ, and the rest will come of itself, since it is the fulfillment of a self-evident law.